The Heritage End of Year Fund Drive is officially on. Become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hi, Bomb Squad. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Each week, we bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life through conversations with the most inspiring women in and around the world of food. First, let's thank our sponsors. Le Cordon Bleu. If you're daydreaming about culinary school, maybe 2019 is the time to say bonjour to Le Cordon Bleu. Learn more about the legendary culinary school's most prestigious professional qualification, Le Grand Diplôme, by visiting cordonbleu.edu. And let's thank Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs. Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs are better than cage-free. They are bullshit-free. Try for yourself. To get your coupon for Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs, head to vitalfarms.com/cherrybomb. And Bob's Red Mill. Bob's Red Mill is an employee-owned company that's been offering organic, gluten-free, and stone-ground products for decades. You know with Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed food that tastes amazing. Go to bobsredmill.com and use the code CHERRYBOMB25 for 25% off your order. I'm sure there are some of you out there still holiday shopping. I know I am. I have some great gift suggestions for the Bomb Squad. First, there's the Cherry Bomb Cookbook, of course. It features more than 100 recipes from 100 influential women in the food space and women who we just happen to love to bits, including Chef Camille Becerra, who gave us her banana bread recipe. And let me tell you, it is the best banana bread on the planet, I swear. Photographer Andrea Gentle and her lentil stew, which we affectionately refer to as Gentle's Lentils here at Cherry Bomb HQ, and writer Clancy Miller's Rosé Sangria. I love that drink. The Cherry Bomb Cookbook is a great book to cook from and read because you can learn all about these awesome women. You can find the Cherry Bomb Cookbook at your favorite indie bookstore. If you need last-minute gifts that you can send via email, head to cherrybomb.com for Jubilee tickets. That would be a most excellent gift. Or for our e-gift cards, which can be used to buy anything on our site. Speaking of Jubilee, if you would like to apply for a scholarship ticket or to volunteer, don't forget the deadline is January 15th. Approaching quickly, visit cherrybomb.com to apply. Is everybody ready for today's show? We are going to be talking about digging in and making change, literally and figuratively. Our first guest is Sara Bliss, a friend of mine from my Yahoo days. Sara was part of the Yahoo Beauty team working under beauty guru Bobby Brown, who was the editor-in-chief of Yahoo Beauty. Some of you might not know that. I ran the Yahoo Food team, and we had a lot of fun while it lasted. Fast forward to right now. Sara has written a book called Take the Leap, Change Your Career, Change Your Life. It's about people who took a chance and pivoted from one job to something totally different. Sara interviewed 75 people to understand how they did it and compiled all their wisdom and practical advice. A lot of you write to me because you want to change your job and work in the food world, so I thought you'd enjoy hearing what Sara learned in the process of researching her book. In the second half of Radio Cherry Bomb, I'll be talking with Taylor Lanzett and Elizabeth Meltz of Dig In, the fine, fast casual restaurant group in New York and Boston, known for working with local farmers and known for its delicious seasonal eats. Some highlights from the current menu: charred Brussels sprouts with honey chili oil, roasted carrots with carrot harissa, and Dig In's cult favorite all year round, the vegan and gluten-free cashew kale Caesar. Hungry for more? Me too. I will be right back with Sara after this word from Le Cordon Bleu. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and pâtisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there: London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, And of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin. So I'm so excited that our next guest is with us, Sara Bliss. Sara and I are friends from our Yahoo days. And if you're a regular listener of the show, you know I talk about Yahoo a lot and our Yahoo time and make fun of it. So Sara worked for Yahoo Beauty and I worked for Yahoo Food, but our I don't know, what'd you call them, our pods?
Yeah.
Our pods were next to each other.
Exactly. So Bobby brought me over right when she was assigned the job as editor-in-chief. She called me and said, would you want to be my senior writer? And up until then, I had gotten into this like sidetrack as a career where I was everybody's ghostwriter. And I wrote two books for Bobby Brown as her co-writer. She's great. She credits all her authors, unlike a lot of people. And then I got to Yahoo, and it was great because it was just me. I wrote for Bobby there as well, but I also wrote a ton on my own. So it was actually a great experience to kind of be back in the world. And the funny thing was, she really didn't want me writing about beauty. She wanted me writing about, in typical Bobby fashion, she likes to kind of do things a little bit differently. And she wanted me to write inspiring profiles about people, because that's actually how I came to her originally. Was she was writing a book called Pretty Powerful, which is a hybrid of profiles and makeup, and she didn't want a beauty writer. She didn't want anyone in the industry, and I've been writing profiles for 20 years. So she wanted that fresh perspective, and then she wanted the same at Yahoo. And it was incredible for me to get myself back out in the world in this big way. And it planted, I had this idea for this book for 10 years, but it was a reminder that these kinds of stories need to be out in the world, and people are really inspired by them. And especially in the beauty world, and you know the food world, there are a lot of these people who have made these kind of pivots. I mean, you're one of them.
Absolutely. I am one of them, yes. I was going to say about Bobby, one interesting thing about how she approached Yahoo Beauty was beauty is so much bigger than just beauty products. It's empowering messages. She did a lot of coverage on food and health and wellness and really pushed that angle of beauty from the inside, which I always appreciated about Bobby.
You know, and what I really like about that is people were constantly trying to get her to stay in her lane, right? They didn't want her talking about health, but she stuck to it. And when people would ask her, what is your biggest beauty secret? The first thing that she would talk about is it's what you eat. It's what you put in your body. And people would be like, why do you look so great? And she's like, I'm not doing injectables and all that stuff. It's what I eat and how I take care
of
myself. Yes,
and
exactly.
I think that goes to the core of part of your message with your book, that if you're in this job that is making you miserable, that's going to eat away at you, and it's just going to show up in everything you do, in your face and your attitude and all of that.
Well, that was the interesting thing about writing Take the Leap, is that a lot of these people, you know, it's not just about people making cool career switches. I mean, that's one big aspect. But for a lot of the people making these changes, they were really solving big issues in their lives. I have people who had, you know, PTSD or crippling anxiety. There was one guy who had agoraphobia. His job set off these triggers of panic attacks, and he literally was not able to leave his house. And it was a therapist who said, all right, well, if you could do anything, what would you do? And his name is Eric Gorgeous. And he said, well, I would work with my hands. And is that going to cure this? Is that going to fix this? And the doctor was like, why don't you try? And now he runs this business called Voodoo Choppers. He makes custom motorcycles. And he hosts a show on PBS called A Craftsman's Legacy. And he's so much happier. And, you know, he said it's not a cure, but it really helped him heal. So there is this big connection, I think, between your mental health and your job. And I think if you don't acknowledge it, you're maybe fooling yourself a little bit.
Sara, I want to go back to what you said about what his therapist said to him. If you could do anything, what would you be doing? I think that's such a great question that we don't ask ourselves very much.
I agree. And I think there's this idea that if you want a job that makes you happy, that somehow that's like superficial a little bit, that there are a lot of people who have this mentality, well, you know, I don't do what I love, and I'm just paying the bills, and I'm not happy, and that's just life, and that's like a grown-up attitude. And I don't think that needs to be the case. And I think that there are a lot of career coaches and, you know, super inspiring Instagram accounts, and they all say this kind of thing. But at the end of the day, you want to see proof, and people need to see proof that there are people like them who have done these kinds of switches and are so much happier. And once they see the proof and it becomes realistic, then I think they're more inspired to make their own switches. And that's a little bit also why I wanted to write this book. I wanted to kind of shake up the whole career advice thing. And also it's a hybrid. It's a little bit self-help. It's a little career-focused. It's like a mix of everything.
How many people did you ultimately interview?
Well, I interviewed probably about 75, but we ended up cutting it down to 63.
Okay. And what would you say were the common denominators among all those people?
I think the first is ultimately everyone at some point got comfortable with risk. And this idea that they could talk themselves and talk to everybody else about whether this was a good idea for months, that there might be a lot of other people who think it's a bad idea, actually. But at the end of the day, they needed just to go for it, to kind of get comfortable with the idea that they might fail. But if they didn't do it, they would never know. And it's also that feeling you don't want to look back and say, oh, I wish I had done this when this opportunity came. So that's the first thing. And then I think the second thing is people really, really needed to, or the majority of people in the book, they also were comfortable with this idea that the life that they thought maybe they were supposed to be living, or their parents told them, or their spouse is telling them, isn't necessarily what they wanted. And so they got to a point where they had to listen to themselves and answer that question and say, like, what do I want to do? Like, what's going to make me happy? Because for a lot of people, you know, they're living these glamorous lives in New York. One woman, Marina De Lima, she was a reality TV producer, and her family thought it was, you know, she had really made it, right? She had this gorgeous apartment and the fancy bags and the handsome boyfriend and the whole thing. And she was really unhappy, and she really didn't like the person she was becoming, especially in reality TV. And she found yoga, and that led her eventually. Now she travels all around the world with a philanthropic retreat company, and she lives in a different country every 3 months. And the first time she did it, she had to make $1,000 stretch for 3 months. And she was able to do it, and she said, wow, I realized what a princess I was. But she is so much happier and feels much, much better about her path, and feels that had she lived the former life, had she stayed on course, it just would have been depression and anxiety and regret.
Another common denominator question of all the people you answered, how many of them had financial safety nets?
So I really made a point to not have the book be full of people with financial safety nets. There are definitely, you know, a bunch that did, but I wanted a lot of people with something to lose. And I wanted a lot of people where we really got into the financial struggle and how they did it. Because I think a lot of times you read these stories and they sound really exciting and amazing, but it's like, well, how did you actually do this? How did you pull this off? I wanted a real range of types of people. In the foodie chapter, I have a former housekeeper named Maria Serrano. And she came here from Mexico, worked in a factory in Queens for a long time. Then she worked for a dry cleaner out in Long Island. And she was working as a housekeeper and a babysitter and just nonstop. And she thought, I don't want to do this forever. And now she runs her own restaurant, and she saved and saved and saved. And she worked for some small restaurants. And when one of them was going out of business, she was able to buy it with a loan from her sister with her savings. And it wasn't easy. She had a summer. She's in Shelter Island. Her restaurant's called Maria's Kitchen. And she had a summer season where it took off and did really well. And she made a lot of money. And then she started investing back into new equipment and things like that. And she got to the winter, and she was like, oh my God, I don't know how I'm going to survive. Like, I don't know if I can make it. And she ended up moving back in with her ex-husband. That's how devoted she was to this business. And now it's 5 years later, I think, and she's figured it out. And she's been able to make it work. But there was certainly a lot of struggle along the way.
And what about side hustles? So how do you know if something should just remain a hobby or a side hustle, or if it should be something you take the leap for?
I think a side hustle is actually a fantastic way to dip your toe into this and kind of figure out if this is going to be a good thing for you, if it's going to be financially viable, because you can do a lot of the marketing work and see if it's something that will work. One of the things that I think ultimately is when you see if you're starting to make more money and gain more traction from that. There are two food stories in the book where that started as side hustles. One is Julie Defense. She was living in Portugal. She was working in a magazine, and she took a baking class on the side because that was her passion. She married into a family. They have 35 nieces. They have no children of their own, but there's 35 nieces and nephews. And so she became everybody's, you know, favorite cake baker. And she took a class.
It's a full-time job.
Yeah. She took a course thinking that this would be like her side business. And when she got more responses from that ad for cakes than she did for ads in her magazine, she realized, okay, I'm onto something. And she made the switch quickly. For other people, it took longer. Kevin Curry, he started an app and a website called Fit Man Cook. He has a new book out. He was working in marketing, and he started when he saw like a picture of himself on Facebook looking really heavy. And he was trying to kind of figure out what the secret was. And he got such a big response and started to make a lot of money from ads. And he thought, all right, well, if I'm getting this amount of money and I'm just doing it part-time, imagine if I put all my energy into it. And he went to a boss. I think he got an offer from Google around this time. And he said no. And he had a boss who said, look, you know, I'll hire you back if this doesn't work. But you don't want to look back and say to your grandkids, I had this like great thing and it could have been something else. But then the story ends with you not going for it. You need to try. And I think he's like one of the top apps, one of the top food apps. And he does really, really well. And he has a huge social media following in this new cookbook. So,
you know, it's coming up on New Year's resolution time. So what do you say to those people who have at the top of their resolutions list, I need a new job?
I think that they have to do the prep work to get there. I think the first thing you should do is to talk to someone who's made the change that you want to make. I think that's going to be better than any book. I mean, besides mine, of course. Any career coach. I think those are the people who are going to tell you this is how to do it. And there are a lot of different ways to connect with those people. I mean, the other thing I always tell people is to take a class, get educated, start taking the steps so that you will have something that makes you seem legitimate and serious about this. Because if you send someone a resume and there's nothing on it, well, you're not going to get called in. But if you send someone a resume and you've taken all these classes and maybe you've done like an internship on the weekends, then you're starting the path for yourself. And a lot of people in the book really found mentors. It's surprising, I think, to a lot of people who don't have that kind of experience, but a lot of people just want to be asked, you know, like, hey, can I talk to you about how you got into this? Like, hey, would you mind if I shadowed you for a day? Or could I talk to your assistant or whatever it is? Like, then you're sowing the seeds to kind of get there.
When I interviewed Martha Stewart for the cover story, she just said what I thought was the best piece of advice, and I've definitely carried it with me. And she said something very similar to what Bobby said in this section of the book. Bobby said, look for a gap in the market.
Yes.
And Martha said something similar. And, you know, when we talk about just this radical change that is surrounding us right now and how dizzying it kind of is, and just the old paths don't work anymore, the old ways don't work anymore, the you know, careers of yesterday are not the careers of tomorrow. But with all that change brings opportunity.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
So I think that whole finding a gap in the market is a really, really smart way to start a business. I think if you see something that's missing, then chances are other people want it too, even if they seem kind of niche. So I have one that's a little bit niche, this guy, Guy Wang in Chicago. He was a lawyer, but he was also kind of into fashion, and he wanted like a really nice custom suit. He couldn't find it. His family's from China. He started this side hustle getting suits from made in Beijing. And he ended up it started to do, he liked it so much more than the law work. And he was like, let me see if I can make this work. And he had a few years where, you know, it was a struggle. And now he makes a lot more than he did as a lawyer. And his biggest clients are some of the Chicago Bears and a lot of the well-known people in Chicago. And his whole thing is when you see that opportunity, there just wasn't anything else like it in Chicago. And when you see it, then you should jump on it. So I do think that that's really, really good advice and a really smart way to go about deciding what you want to do. And also Bobby talked about, well, you have to see a gap in the market, but you also need to really see what the competition is. Because a lot of people think their ideas are genius, but, you know, there are a lot of people putting shea butter in a jar and saying, like, this is the best cream ever. But if you can't figure out a way to really stand out, then you should maybe hesitate on that idea. You see the gap, and then really assess the competition if there is any, and figure out a way that you can really stand out.
What do you think are some of the most interesting careers of the future? You had to predict.
That's a really good question. I think more and more people, the whole working for yourself thing, I think that the whole millennial generation, I think they're very comfortable with starting businesses, marketing themselves, which is something, not to date myself, but it's not something that I didn't grow up with a camera in front of me every second, so I'm not very comfortable marketing myself. I've had to really, really make a radical mind shift on that and do all the work so that I'm comfortable having a conversation with you. That's how I became kind of the behind the scenes person, because I wasn't. But I do think that comfort with marketing themselves and social media, all of that is kind of leading to people starting these businesses. And also, you don't have to go to business school anymore. I mean, I have, there's a woman in the book, she started Carbon 38. Her name's Katie Warner Johnson. She was a fitness instructor, and she was getting injured and getting older and realized that the doors were closing and she had to come up with something new. And she went to like a startup weekend with a friend, I think two friends, and they were going to come up with a Yelp of fitness. And they ended up applying to an accelerator program that gave them, I think it was $25,000 for 3 months to work on an idea. And they ended up coming up with the idea for Carbon 38. And then she raised $1 million in $25,000 increments and was able to launch the company. And now...
Hold on, I'm doing that math. So that's 40.
Yeah.
Yeah. 40 investors.
That's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And she ended up, Foot Locker is now a minority owner. They just did a big investment in the company. So, you know, one of the things she said to me was, well, you know, I originally thought that I would have to go to business school. If I had gone to business school, I would have sat on this idea for 2 years. And then maybe someone else would have done it and I would have missed my window. So the whole accelerator world is one that I didn't know about before writing the book. The other thing is a lot of people in the book taught themselves how to code in order to launch different online platforms. They went and did Ruby on Rails. This woman, Tiffany Pham, she has a women's networking career platform called Mogul, and she taught herself Ruby on Rails. She while doing like three other jobs. I mean, she's incredible. But
tell us what Ruby on Rails is.
It is a coding course, and apparently it's one of the easier ones to grasp. I think a lot of them are very, very difficult. And she felt, and I've heard a few people in the book, once they discovered Ruby on Rails, it was like that hallelujah moment of, oh, I can do this. And then, you know, a lot of times people don't have a budget to hire a coder or someone to build their website for them. So doing that, being able to do it yourself, it makes all the difference.
So you mentioned Ruby on Rails, you mentioned accelerator programs. Earlier in the show, you had mentioned how great Instagram is as a marketing tool and how LinkedIn is a great connector tool. What are some other tools that these different people who you interviewed, but also that you just know that either career switchers or new entrepreneurs could have access to that are super helpful?
I think evening ongoing education classes and then online courses if you're not in a big city. I think the whole nighttime class thing, because all of a sudden you're now meeting people that can connect you to other people if you do a good job. Your professor will definitely know people. And then you're also meeting other people that are in the same industry. I took a writing for magazines class. I originally started in the art world, and I wanted to I wanted to go into magazines. I couldn't get a job. I was an art history major. So I went into the art world and I just thought, this isn't for me. It's like just too like fancy pants. Like I'm just moving art from one Park Avenue apartment to another. And I tried to get a job in magazines and I couldn't. So I did that thing to make me legitimate, which was to take a class at night. And interestingly enough, I just reached out to one of those women who was in my class, who's a producer at a big television network. And now we're talking about doing the book on there. So you also making those contacts. There is there's a podcast called Breaking Into Startups. And one of the guys on that podcast gave advice for how to break into startups when you're not a coder or an engineer. And one of the things he talks about and his big piece of advice and how he did it was he went on LinkedIn, he found people who were in the company he wanted to be in, and he sent them these notes and said, you know, hey, I'm, you know, really, really interested in getting in this, and this is the work that I'm doing to get there. Like, would you be willing to talk to me for 10 minutes on the phone, or would you be willing to answer a few questions over email? Or he actually had a couple of people that said they would meet him for coffee. And that's how he broke in. So that networking piece is also very, very key.
All right. Well, this has been great. So for all of you who want to start the new year fresh and are thinking that has to do with your profession and your career, you definitely want to pick up Take the Leap by Sara Bliss. It is a wonderful book. I'm super inspired by it, and I definitely am not going to be changing my career next year. I've had enough change this year. But it was wonderful to see you. I miss the Yahoo gang.
I do, too. And I've been back in touch with a lot of them for this book, which has been really, really fun and wonderful to reconnect. And everyone's been so supportive. So,
well, thank you for putting this out into the world for everybody who needs it.
Thank you. Yes, I hope a lot of people will read it and take the leap. I really want to hear those stories.
Wonderful. All right. Take care.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break for a word from our sponsors, then we'll be back with Taylor Lanzett and Elizabeth Meltz of Dig In. Does this happen to you? You need a dozen eggs, you go to the supermarket, you head to the egg section, and you are so confused by what you find there, you freeze. You want nice eggs on hand because maybe you want a cheese and herb omelet for dinner, or you want to poach an egg to slip on your avocado toast, and you know quality eggs make a big difference. And you're a decent person, so it's important the chickens have a good life. But as you stand there, you think to yourself, I have no idea what all these words on the egg cartons mean. So you shrug, pick one, and continue shopping. Stop right there. You are a busy lady. You don't need this bullshit in your life. You need bullshit-free eggs, which is where Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs come in. Their pasture-raised hens roam outside in 108 square feet of space per hen. Those cage-free hens, they never go outside. I tasted the difference once I tried Vital Farms eggs. Try for yourself. To get your coupon for Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs, head to vitalfarms.com/cherrybomb. It's time for our Bob's Red Mill Minute. As we get closer to 2019, I know many of you are thinking about resolutions. Is one of your resolutions to be more adventurous in the kitchen? If so, head over to bobsredmill.com and discover a few new ingredients. You can expand your pantry and your cooking repertoire with things like cassava flour, hulled hemp seed hearts, and petite French green lentils, and bring some new flavors into your life. Who knows? Maybe spelt berries are going to rock your world, and nutritional yeast is just the thing that has been missing from your life. As you head out on your culinary adventure, don't forget to use the code CHERRY25 at checkout for 25% off your order. You know, with Bob's Red Mill, say it with me, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed food that tastes amazing.
Next year, Heritage Radio Network is turning 10. For the last decade, we've been committed to bringing listeners around the world the very best in food radio, for free. Our small staff and incredible network of hosts work hard so that listeners can tune in each week to hear the important conversations in food policy, stay on the cutting edge of cocktail culture, and hear the latest updates in food tech. But there is no HRN without the support of listeners like you. Become a member of Heritage Radio Network today and help HRN get a strong start to our second decade. Choose from exclusive member gifts and stay in the loop on discounts to upcoming events. There's no better time to show your support. go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and wish HRN a happy birthday.
Let's return to the show. Next up, we have two friends from Dig In, Taylor Lanzett and Elizabeth Meltz. Taylor is the Director of Supply and Sustainability for Dig In, and Elizabeth is the Senior Director of Environmental Health, two very timely jobs. If you were at Jubilee earlier this year, you know that we are Dig In super fans here at Cherry Bomb, and that Dig In cooked an awesome lunch for all the attendees. Taylor and Elizabeth stopped by to talk about Dig In and why so many people really dig what this growing restaurant group is all about. Enjoy our conversation. For those who don't live in New York or Boston and who haven't had the pleasure of going to Dig In, tell us what Dig In is all about.
Dig In is a fine, fast, casual restaurant group that focuses on direct sourcing with farmers and building really great culinary and dining experiences.
So you all, if you're listening closely, you all caught that Taylor said fine, fast. Tell us what, because the terms everybody throws around now, like fast casual, what's the difference between fast casual and fine fast?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of combining the best parts about fine dining, which are great hospitality and exceptional sourcing and food, with a really quick dining experience and at casual prices. The terms are definitely a little bit complicated, but I think what we do really well is find really great food, cook delicious food, and then work with a team, and our hospitality and culinary teams are just engaged and excited to be there. So the experience itself is really warm.
You know, I was just thinking, you literally could get that woman who does the art of plating. Do you look at her Instagram account?
No.
Oh my God, you have to look at it. She just basically, she is the life. She goes everywhere and just gets to hang out with people who plate things beautifully. And I feel like you could take Dig In food, get somebody to plate it with a bunch of tweezers and some squeeze bottles, and you might not be able to tell the difference.
Yeah.
You know, the food's really great, and the sourcing is great.
Yeah. A lot of what we focus on is when you walk in to Dig In, hoping that the experience is not only as pleasant as possible, but you can trust that we have thought about pretty much every step of the process. So you can point to the Chioga beets and feel confident in where they're from and that they're cooked well. And I feel like that's, we've really
and handled safely.
And handled safely.
Now, you are a big part of where the food comes from.
Right.
So tell us what your job is all about, because you have a very unique job.
Yeah. My job is to find producers and growers who fit and match the Dig In ethos and bring their food to our restaurants. And so that looks like a variety of ways. Sometimes I shop at the farmer's market and find people that way. Other times someone calls me and says, hey, can you talk to Mark down the road? He's growing a lot of garlic and he wants to sell it to you.
And or I just, one of our employees' moms grows potatoes.
One of our employees' moms grows potatoes and they put me in contact with Doris and talk to Doris pretty much every day for the past month, and we're trying to buy some potatoes. What we do as a team is we focus on if the grower, the producer is the right fit. And what that means for us is if they think about food in the same way that Dig In does. Are they caring for their employees the same way we do? Are they caring for the earth and that their mission is to leave the soil and their season in a better place than when they started? Do they care about what inputs they're putting into the ground? And most importantly, my favorite growers are the ones who, after we start buying their products, say, hey, how is the broccoli? How are the string beans? How is everything tasting? Because for them, the reason they like working with us is because they know that we care as much about the product as they do. And it's not just about moving a box, but it's moving a case of carrots that a lot of people spent time growing. And a lot of care went into that one bag of carrots. So we focus on that, and there's no grower that's too small or for us to work with. Team makes fun of me, but I'll pretty much go to the ends of the earth to buy someone's two cases of kale because that's all they can send us. And I think that is one thing that has differentiated us and made us really special in our supply chain.
Yeah, I was going to ask, the big term these days is scale. How do you scale everything? You know, people ask me that about Cherry Bomb. For something like Dig In, where you've got investors, you know, some of your competitors, all you hear about is how much money they raise. Yeah, They're not talking about their farmers and where they source the food from. How does Dig In as an organization deal with that? And what are the priorities? What is the philosophy?
The interesting thing about scale for us is that no one has really built what we're trying to do. So there's no one to look to and say, hey, this is a really good example. So that's where the fun begins, at least for us, where we get to say, this is all new, and we get to try a bunch of different things. So our New York supply chain looks different from our Boston one, and it will look different from our Philly one. And I think what's special and unique about that is what we're trying to highlight is that in every new place we go, we're going to celebrate the local atmosphere of that region. And I have no idea how it's going to look, to be honest. But what I know is we're committed to working with people, and that means knowing their first name and knowing what they need for their business. So one farmer we work with, Alewife, who's a dear friend, for us, they are a big carrot grower, and they've invested in scaling up carrot production for us. I have another grower, Rocksteady, who really only wants to send us 10 cases, and that's scale for them, and that's what we're committed to. So I think it's a matter of going into it as a buyer and saying, we're not going to make you conform to what we think scale is. You're going to tell us what you can do, and then we're going to do our best to make that work. And that's really putting the grower first.
How are things for small-scale farms these days?
Dark. Yeah, it was a pretty brutal season.
Because of the weather,
yeah. The rain and the humidity resulted in pretty dire loss in the fields. We lost over 30 acres of broccoli. These are crops that we committed to in February and then totally obliterated a week before harvest. Cauliflower was awful. Peaches was like a tragedy. But the part that's most concerning beyond climate change and weather and patterns that we can't predict is just for these smaller growers where they don't have the security of maybe like as diverse set of portfolio as some of the larger growers. They're just sort of hoping it all works out. And maybe what happens is all the peaches come in a little imperfect and you need a buyer who's willing to accept that and work with them. And that's where I feel like we position ourselves to be really helpful versus saying like, nope, that's not perfect. We're not going to try. And so maybe that means taking cauliflowers that's all different sizes and with all different yields and trying to be the partner that says, yeah, you know what, we can handle this. Yeah, and I think that a lot of the small-scale growers are also very concerned about what's going to happen with some new food safety regulations that are rolling out. FSMA is going to be, Food Safety Modernization Act, is going to be very challenging for some that are looking to scale, and there are certain regulations that might make it harder for them to do certain things. There are small things, like you can't have a wooden broom, like, in your washing station. Like, and it's just like, who regulates that?
It's a good pass of the baton yes. to Elizabeth.
Yeah,
who so does that? The Food Safety Monitoring Act.
Modernization.
Food Safety Modernization
Act. The Food Safety yeah. Modernization Act.
Right. So the
what
first
is that
thing
all about?
I want to say, though, is that before I got to dig in, I had heard heard Taylor speak, or we sort of knew each other casually, and I was like, this sounds great, good for you. But now that I work there, I realize that, like, everything Taylor is saying is true, and it's hard to believe because we have so many locations. I hear these conversations, and I'm on the emails or the Slacks that say, like, cauliflower is going to be a little bit big, Brussels sprouts are going to be, everybody who works there is invested in this. So props to you. And it's a privilege to
it's
work
remarkable.
Somewhere.
Yes. I mean, it's what fancy farm to table restaurants are doing.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's incredible. And by definition, it sounds not believable, but it is true. I don't know how we're going to scale it, but we're going to do it. The same challenges for food safety, right? I think one of the reasons I'm a good fit for Dig In and why we get along so well is that the idea will not be like, can you, farmer A, comply with X, Y, and Z? Nope. Okay. It'll be more like, what can we do to help to get you there? And it's going to be a lot of work, but
That's, I think, where our roles are really going to nicely overlap as we scale, where we want to be the group, either in agriculture or restaurants, that says, hey, we need to get here. Let's build this together.
Yeah.
And let's do it in a really meaningful way, because if we do it together well, then we can share it with someone else.
Yes.
And there's no reason to sort of keep that success or great partnership locked up. So.
Yeah. Definitely.
So, Elizabeth, how did you become a food safety expert?
I don't know if I would call myself an expert. Although, as a woman, I should say, I'll tell you how I became an expert. I was a line cook for many years. I actually was a line cook in Rome. After culinary school, I worked at Oriole for Charlie Palmer. Not a lot of people, people should know him. He was one of the first, American celebrity chefs. And I remember in culinary school learning about food safety where everybody else was like falling asleep. I was like, wow, this is really interesting. And it just became a theme throughout the jobs that I had as far as like the role that I took on, or just, you know, in a very natural way. And then I was at Del Posto shortly after they opened in 2006. And I was probably, I should remember exactly, but I was probably like 28 years old by that time. And I was thinking, I don't want to be a chef. I don't want to own my own restaurant. I love Mark Ladner. He's a genius. I'm enjoying working with him, but like, I'm getting old, which is funny now. But what can I do that's still in this? I love this company. What can I do still in this vein, but not? And so we created together, Chef Mark and I created a kitchen manager position. I did, you know, payroll, benefits, but also all of our food safety compliance, helped some of the chefs with the ordering, our first Green Restaurant Association certification. So the sustainability and the food safety emerged out of that. And then just studying classes, certifications, experience on the ground. I feel like having been a line cook makes me much more successful. You're not going to go in and be like, nobody use towels, having been there. And it builds credibility because people are like, they trust me not to say silly things. Which it goes back to the conversation about the farmers, which is I understand that a wooden broom in your kitchen, it should not be a violation. We will respect that it is, but we will work with you to work around it.
I know your menu changes on a regular basis. So tell us what is on the menu right now.
Yeah, we're in our fall, late fall menu right now. And we have roasted carrots with a carrot harissa, which is out of this world. We have on our staple, which is a sauteed broccoli, and it's amazing that the amount of people who just want broccoli. It's like a true childhood favorite.
Yeah. Wait, no one had broccoli as a childhood favorite.
Right, that they liked. Well, maybe they're like redoing their
grown-up favorite. Yeah. We have Brussels sprouts.
Love broccoli as a child?
I love broccoli,
you
yes.
Did.
Okay. It all makes sense now. We have Brussels sprouts with a honey chili oil. And they're dynamite, and it's really funny because they're selling so well that we are buying about 2,500 pounds of local honey a week. And our honey farmer reached out to me and was like, Taylor, this is crazy. Like, how do you expect me to have this much honey? Of course they do, so it's all working out. But it was just like four times what we thought it would be because everyone loves Brussels sprouts.
They're good.
Okay. We have honey nut squash with a puffed rice.
What's a honey nut squash?
Yeah, honey nut squash is one of the original Cornell / Dan Barber seed collaborations, where it was the sweeter butternut that's short and sort of individual sized. And we just slice that in half and really feature the squash as is.
Well, I've seen those in my farmer's market. I didn't know there was a Dan Barber.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So that's one of the original seed collaborations that launched into Row 7.
Dan Barber, Blue Hill.
Yes.
For those who aren't sure who Dan is.
And the other thing that's really fall right now is our maple cauliflower, which has been back, I think this is our fourth year, because it's such a crowd pleaser. So, whenever it leaves the menu, we get so many guest emails that are like, please bring this back. And it's really simple with chickpea crunch, and it's awesome.
Shout out to Esther, who fields all those emails.
Poor Esther.
Yeah.
Yum. Do you ever share recipes on the website?
We do a lot of modified recipes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Chef Matt Weingarten, who's our chief culinary officer, will share some like home versions, mm-hmm. where we don't give away all the secret sauce, but he does make it pretty simple. And I think what most people don't realize is our roasted broccoli is roasted broccoli with garlic and lemon. Yeah. Like, we're not doing anything crazy. We're just buying really good food and cooking it really well.
Well, I mean, I think that's why people love Dig In so much. I have never not stood online at Dig In. It's not like sitting online at an airport that like actually does move fast.
Yeah.
But lunchtime, there's a line.
Yeah.
People dig in.
Totally. And people want to go multiple times a week. And I mm-hmm. think that's the piece that really makes the food stand out, where you have a great amount of flavor, but you also have simplicity where you're not tired of it.
Right. No palate fatigue. And if you work for us, you can eat lunch for free.
Ooh, that's a big perk.
Yeah.
Nice.
Great perk.
Yeah. How often does the menu change at Dig In?
So right now, the menu changes 6 times a year. And we're looking at changing that up a bit. Because one thing we've noticed is, like many of our competitors in the space, the way that you do a menu cycle is that you decide on this date and then you do all of this back end work to make sure that you're ready to go. But nature and supply doesn't cooperate that way. So when you say that July 6th is the launch date, that is so arbitrary at this point. And so we're looking to have maybe a more constant, fluid, changing menu that actually supports our culinary and supply work a lot better.
And I understand that if you work at Dig In, you have to have a spirit vegetable, correct?
I never did that exercise, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
That was when I was interviewing the Tanya Fogg, who was working in HR at the time, asked me if I had any other questions for the group. And I said, what's everyone's spirit vegetable? And then I'm pretty sure they were like,
wow.
So that started with you.
Yeah.
Oh, love it. God. What's your spirit vegetable?
Carrot.
And do you have a carrot tattoo?
I do. Okay.
You do. I remember that.
Do I scream a certain vegetable to you?
Wait, you have to think about what vegetable. Write it down. Write down what vegetable she screams. And you write down what your spirit vegetable is. And then you can.
Is it just like a vegetable?
I need a minute.
Don't blurt it out until Taylor writes it down.
Is it about like I'm salty and sweet kind of thing? Or is it just like
whatever you personify. Yeah. You know enough about vegetables that.
What vegetable is in your soul?
Yeah, I think I got
it. Or what vegetable speaks to your soul. Oh, she has to write it down for it. You have to write it down and cover your answer.
Let's see.
We'll give her a little clock.
It's so hard.
All right. Elizabeth.
I put down radicchio.
Nice. Similar family.
Okay.
I said broccoli raw.
Ooh, good one. Yes.
Yeah, same attribute.
Yes.
I'm thinking mostly because you have broccoli, which is like everyone's introduction to like a classic, but the rob is a little bit bitter. Right?
It has a little Scorpio in there,
A little bit Scorpio, but then becomes a classic for everyone.
Yeah.
Also Italian.
Yeah.
I do love
on
broccoli
her Italian
rob.
Thing.
Yeah.
Why'd you say radicchio?
I just really like it, and it's like, you can eat it raw, you can eat it cooked. I like to melt mozzarella on it, a little balsamic.
Yeah.
It's pretty. Tardy. I don't know. I mean, not that I think I'm pretty, but like that was why I was drawn to that vegetable.
Nice.
I mean,
flavor profile. Yeah.
Yeah. We eat broccoli in my house every day, but that seems kind
of. How do you make it?
Just olive oil, salt, and pepper. My kids eat it like it is going out of style.
You roast it?
Yeah, in a pan.
Roasted.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But that
I
just seems
roasted
like
broccoli.
Low hanging. So good.
Yeah. How do you cook radicchio?
Same thing. Heat up the olive oil, sear it on both sides. Then I usually slice, it's better with, scamorza or a smoked mozzarella, but I don't love smoked. And then lay that on top, put it in the broiler or the oven for a minute, and you can drizzle it with an aged balsamic. It's really yummy.
Yum.
Yeah.
And do you eat it much in salads?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Endive
nice
was
and
another thing I was thinking of. I love endive. Yeah. I mean, that's the amazing thing about working for Dig In. You're literally just eating vegetables cooked to their own perfection. Like, not a lot of crap on them, just like, this is a carrot and it is delicious.
Do you miss cooking professionally?
No. I cook a lot at home. I loved cooking for many years, served a purpose. I love that, like, as a line cook, you have a beginning, a middle, and an end, right? You know, and you know what you need for tomorrow and you can get ahead. It's very, like, linear and I'm organized, but it's exhausting. It's hard on your body. It's like fighting a war every night. And I, you know, I'm done with that. But I'm glad I did it, and I think it, you know, it informed who I am. Although I think if I were to get on a line these days, it would be a very different world.
How so?
I think things that were accepted when I was coming up, you know, back to our earlier conversation. Also, for me, picking thyme leaves in the corner until my fingers were bloody for 5 hours was actually part of character building and, like, you know, discipline and things like that. But I wouldn't recommend that, and I don't think they do that anymore. A lot of that grunt work.
Who does the grunt work now?
I mean, I think everybody does. I think instead of just like hiring an intern and being like, you do all the crap that nobody wants to do.
Like that French apprentice thing. You will cut carrots for the next 2 years of your life until you are perfect.
Exactly.
At it. Yeah. That doesn't exist anymore.
No.
Yeah.
Nor should it, but I will say there was some value to it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess discipline, but not very humane.
Right. And it was interesting because the second I got promoted out of intern to like Garmager or to Hot Apps, and a new intern would come in and people would say, well, give it to them. And I had to do it. Now they should have to do it. And I was like, let's break that chain. I didn't like it when I had to do it. You didn't like it when you had to do it. So why should we make someone else?
Absolutely. Great to see you both. I know you're newer, but Diggin has been very supportive of Cherry Bomb. So
yay.
Thank you for that. It's always fun hanging out with the gang at Jubilee. And have a great holiday season.
Thank you.
Thank you. You too.
All right. That's it for today's show. Thank you to Sarah Bliss for talking to me about her new book, Take the Leap, Change Your Career, Change Your Life. If you are thinking about switching it up in 2019 and you need a little courage or encouragement, you should check it out. And thank you to Taylor Lanzett and Elizabeth Meltz for stopping by. If you are in New York City or Boston, be sure to check out Dig In. Maybe try the maple cauliflower with chickpea crumble or the Jasper Hill mac and cheese or any of their yummy offerings, and you'll understand why we dig what they do. Thank you to our sponsors, Bob's Red Mill, Vital Farms Pasture-Raised Eggs, and Le Cordon Bleu Culinary School for supporting Radio Cherry Bomb. Thank you to our associate producer and very own Riot Girl, Jess Seidman, and to the band Tra La La for our theme song. Today's podcast was recorded at The Wing in Dumbo. The Wing is a work and community space for women, designed by women. For more information about The Wing, visit the-wing.com. Don't forget to pick up the new issue of Cherry Bomb Magazine, featuring wellness advocate Sophia Rowe on the cover. It's out now at places like Omnivore Books in San Francisco, Casa Magazines in Manhattan, Book Larder in Seattle, and Miracle Plum in Santa Rosa, California. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening, everyone. You are the bomb.
Are you crying? There's no crying! There's no crying in baseball!
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.